What I'd initially thought to be a detailed statement seemed to be a lot more speculative upon closer inspection. Do you think maybe you've underestimated the startup costs? I've read with startup businesses you should assume that you won't make a profit for at least the first 6 months, sometimes as long as 18 months. And you don't have any salaries here for either of us. How will we pay our bills? Graham groaned, stepped in front of me, gathered his materials, and closed the file. Excuse me for trying to do something to improve our situation. In case you're forgetting, I'm the one who went to college, and I'm the one with the advanced degree, and I'm the one who's been working the past 3 years in corporate law. He shook his head and turned his back to me. You know what? Forget it. Just forget I ever mentioned it. He tossed his file on the coffee table, walked back to the front door, and grabbed his car keys off the counter. Where are you going? I asked. Out, he said. The door slammed shut. Minutes later, the Porsche roared as it exited the underground garage and accelerated down the street. I looked out the window at the glow of the street lamp and the tops of the trees planted in the sidewalk. The moon had settled over the bridge, light reflecting off the river. After a moment, I reconsidered the file on the table, opened it, and studied the numbers again. Chapter 7. Tuesday. Having lived her entire life in the Pacific Northwest, Tracy was familiar with both the statistical facts and the mystique of Mount Rainier. At more than 14,000 feet, Rainier wasn't just a mountain. It was a volcano of head-swiveling immensity that dominated the region. Visible for hundreds of miles in every direction, it was so immense and tall it created its own weather patterns. Even when the mountain could not be seen, when the Pacific Northwest gray hung like a thick curtain over the region, you could sense the mountain's presence. Seattleites said things like, "The mountain is out," as if Rainier were a living, breathing thing. As beautiful as Rainier was, its allure could frequently be deadly. Thousands attempted to reach its summit each year, though more than half failed. Some died. Of those who had perished, some had never been found, their bodies buried under avalanches of ice, snow, and rock, or frozen at the bottom of 100-foot-deep crevasses. For someone looking to fake her own death, Mount Rainier was the perfect killer. Just short of an hour and a half after leaving Seattle, Kin strove beneath the peaked pediment designating the northeast entrance to Mount Rainier National Park. He followed the road to an American flag hanging from a pole outside a log cabin no bigger than a schoolhouse set amid tall pines. When Tracy stepped from the car and stretched the tightness from her body, she smelled the familiar scent of wintergreen, which made her fondly recall growing up in the North Cascades, but also the odor of ash and soot, a rust-colored haze from fires raging unabated in eastern Washington choked the air. She and Kins entered the White River Ranger Station. A ranger greeted them in khaki shorts, a matching short-sleeved shirt, and boots. "You must be the two detectives from Seattle," he extended a hand. "I'm Glenn Hicks. We've had our share of weirdness, but this takes the cake." "Ditto," Kin said. Hicks stood an inch or so shorter than Tracy, perhaps 5'9", but with a wiry build, meaty forearms, and prominent calves. His hairline had receded, which was ironic because hair seemed to cover every other visible part of his body. A 5 o'clock shadow and tufted eyebrows that sloped in toward the bridge of his nose gave him a perpetually disappointed look. "Come on back," Hicks said, inviting them behind a wooden counter to an office not much bigger than a child's bedroom. A wooden desk reminded Tracy of the teacher's desks at Cedar Grove Middle School. On it rested a lone manila file. "When was this cabin built?" Tracy asked. "The station?" Hicks said. 1929. They built them to last back then, though without many amenities." He stepped behind the desk. "You have the picture?" he asked, clearly interested in getting to the bottom of the mystery. Tracy opened her leather saddlebag and pulled out the picture of Lynn Hoff's driver's license. This was not a photocopy, but a 5x8 glossy Foz had obtained from DOL. She handed it across the desk. Hicks put on a pair of cheaters, held up the picture to consider it, then methodically opened the file on his desk, pulled out a second photograph, and held the two side by side, eyes shifting back and forth between them. His head did that slow shake of someone who couldn't believe he'd had one pulled over on him.
"That's her," he said, jaw taut. "I don't know who Lynn Hoff is, but that right there is Andrea Strickland."
He handed both photographs to Tracy and Kins. They compared the two. Though in the DOL's photograph, Strickland wore thick-framed glasses, it was not difficult to tell it was the same person.
"I have others," Hicks said,
opening a manila envelope and taking out color photographs.
"Her husband provided them just about 4 weeks ago, when we thought she'd gone missing on the mountain."
In one, Andrea Strickland stood on a rock, dressed in shorts and a tank top, a long-sleeve shirt tied around her waist, the immense summit of Mount Rainier rising up behind her.
"What can you tell us about that?" Tracy said.
"I can tell you she apparently caused us a lot of unnecessary aggravation and put the lives of my rangers at risk," Hicks said, sounding like a jilted lover. "Someone who does this has to be incredibly selfish."
"Well, she's dead, so she paid the ultimate price," Tracy wanted to say, but refrained.
She and Kins were content to let Hicks vent. He had the right. Andrea Strickland had pulled one over on Hicks and his men. She'd pulled one over on everyone, except the person who'd eventually found and killed her. Hicks swiveled his chair, which squeaked and creaked, and pointed to a tattered U.S. geological topo map on the wall. The area looked to be of the entire park, pocked with prominent red X's, some circled.
"The X's mark the locations where each person still missing on the mountain was last seen. The ones circled are the bodies we've eventually located and recovered. Sometimes it's a few days. Sometimes it can be months and years. Sometimes they're never found. With the warm weather the past few years, the glaciers are receding at an unprecedented rate. We're finding bodies of climbers gone missing for decades, and let me tell you, it never becomes routine. You're haunted by the ones you can't find, always second-guessing yourself, wondering if maybe they were just a few yards from where you were probing the snow, or lying in a crevasse just beneath your boots."
Hicks opened the desk drawer, took out a permanent marker, and drew a circle around one of the X's. He capped the pen and looked back at them.
"Andrea Strickland. I don't need names. I can plot where each climber was last seen in my sleep."
Hicks's finger moved to the specific areas as he said them. "Near Success Cleaver, a crevasse on the Cowlitz Glacier in the Carbon River area." He tapped the pen on the X he had just circled.
"Liberty Ridge. You know why we worked so hard to get the bodies back?"
Tracy did. She'd spent 20 years looking for Sarah, though she'd known with near certainty they would find only her remains.
"Closure for the families," she said.
"Closure for the families," Hicks nodded. "Not everyone buys our bullshit that the mountain is a beautiful final resting place for their loved ones. I don't blame them. But it's also closure for us. May 30th, 2014, we lost 6 in one incident. We found 3 of the bodies last summer. Some years, like last year, we get lucky and don't lose any. It's a tough mountain, and it can turn mean in a hurry. 1 minute the sun is out, and the next it's a whiteout, and the wind is blowing 80 miles an hour. You can never predict what it might do on any given day, and that means you can never relax. That radio can go off at any moment."
"What can you tell us about Andrea Strickland?" Tracy asked.
Hicks realized he'd been venting.
"Sorry, I guess I'm a little emotional about this."
"No worries," Kin said. "I'd say you have the right."
Hicks took a moment to gather his composure.
"Andrea Strickland and her husband Graham took out a wilderness permit to climb Liberty Ridge on May 13th, 2017.
Liberty Ridge is no picnic. It's one of the least climbed paths to the summit.
How many paths are there? Kins asked.
50, at least.
And this one is not frequently climbed because it's difficult or dangerous? Tracy asked.
Both.
It's not technically challenging. There are one or two spots where you have to rope up and belay someone, but you're not climbing ice cliffs.
What makes it so difficult? Tracy said.
The north face of the mountain, Willis Wall. It can be like a bowling alley, especially the last few years with the warmer weather. As the glacier melts and the snow destabilizes, rocks and boulders tumble down the slope.
So not many people on that route, Kin said.
No, Hicks said, which might be why they chose it.
What do you mean? Tracy asked.
I checked the permits taken out that weekend, hoping someone might have seen her. No one else took out a permit to climb that route that weekend. They went early in the season for Liberty Ridge, which is limited to a 6-week to 2-month window of opportunity, weather permitting. I remember questioning the husband about why they'd chosen to climb that route so soon in the season.
What did he say? Tracy asked.
He said they wanted the challenge, that they'd done Disappointment Cleaver and the Emmons Glacier. Those are the two most popular routes. Turns out only she made the summit on Disappointment Cleaver. He crapped out. Altitude sickness. They didn't climb Emmons Glacier. He lied. I found that out after the fact.
Why would he lie?
To get the Liberty Ridge permit? Make it look like they had experience? He talked a big game, I remember that.
So they weren't that experienced, Tracy said.
Experience is a broad spectrum. They'd climbed before, but I wouldn't call either experienced, and I told them so.
I take it they didn't have a guide? Kins asked.
No, Hicks leaned back. 25% of the fatalities on the mountain each year occur on that route. Guides don't like it.
So what did happen? Kins asked.
Hicks chuckled, but there was no joy in it. Well, now I'm not so sure.
What did the husband say happened? Tracy asked.
The husband came down all flustered and exhausted. He said they'd climbed up to Thumb Rock. Hang on.
Hicks opened desk drawers and pulled out a map, unfolding it and turning it to face Tracy and Kins. He leaned over the desk, pencil in hand.
Okay, like I said, they took out a wilderness permit May 13th here at the Wilderness Information Center. The Liberty Ridge climb can take anywhere from 3 to 5 days. Most do it in 3. I know people who have done it in 2. The husband said they left the White River campground and spent the first night at the Glacier Basin Camp.
Hicks scribbled a few pencil lines to indicate the area.
The next day, they hiked here, to the wedge. The route to the left takes you to Camp Sherman over the Emmons Glacier. To the right is the Liberty Ridge route. They crossed St. Elmo Pass, descended onto the Winthrop Glacier, and made their way to Curtis Ridge and set up camp the second night. He said they awoke at midnight, roped up, and made their way up to Thumb Rock.
Hicks circled the two words on the map.
They hiked at night, Kins said. You go when it's cold out to minimize the chances of getting hit by loose rock, and because the snow is firmer and easier to climb. That's about a 4 to 5 hour hike from about 8,800 feet to just under 11,000 feet. They set up camp at Thumb Rock the third night.
And they were alone? Tracy asked.
No other climbers up there?
No,
Hicks said. But this is where the husband's story started to break down. Or at least, I thought it did.
Hicks stretched his back as if it hurt him.
He says they had a light dinner, drank tea, and went inside their tent at around 8 to rest. They planned to get up at 1 and head for the summit. He said he heard Andrea get up, but he didn't check the time. She told him she was going out to pee, and he says he went back to sleep.
Hicks made a face like he wasn't buying it.
He claims he slept through his alarm, that when he woke it was morning and his wife wasn't in the tent. When he went outside looking for her, she was nowhere to be found. He made it here to the ranger station at just after 5 that afternoon and reported her missing.
Why didn't he call? Why did he wait until he got back down? Kins asked.
Cell reception is spotty at best on the mountain.
What was his demeanor? Tracy asked.
Measured, Hicks said, without hesitation.
So not panicked or distraught, Tracy said.
Hicks shook his head. If anything, I'd say he looked and sounded more confused than distraught. He said he didn't know why his wife might have wandered off or what could have happened. Then he started hypothesizing, saying that maybe she'd gone out to go to the bathroom and became disoriented, lost her way and fell off the side of the mountain. Here's what I don't understand. She doesn't come back and he doesn't go looking for her immediately? People are anxious the night before a climb. They don't sleep well, if at all. This guy says he slept through his alarm? I was dead certain he pushed her over the edge.
Did you find any sign of her? Tracy asked.
We did, Hicks said, with just the hint of a smile. The search involved about 20 people, climbing rangers and Nordic Ski Patrol search and rescue. I had members of the Tacoma, Everett, and Seattle Mountain Rescue Units conducting the ground search, and the U.S. Army Reserve 214th Aviation Battalion from Lewis McChord conducting the air search. Like I said, a lot of resources and a lot of money. We arrived at Thumb Rock late the following afternoon. The air search spotted what appeared to be a debris field here at the base of the Willis Wall.
Hicks made a mark on the map.
A debris field of what? Kins asked. Crampons, a pack, water bottle, a few articles of clothing.
The husband identified them?
He did.
But no body?
No body.
How far a fall is that? Tracy asked.
Couple thousand feet.
Seems if there was debris, there'd be a body, Kins said.
Not necessarily. I can tell you what we were thinking at the time. There's a bergschrund at the base of the wall.
Hicks continued to use the pencil on the topo map.
A bergschrund? Tracy asked. It's a German term. It means a large crevasse where the glacier ice separates from the head wall.
And the presumption was she fell into that crevasse never to be found, Kins said. Hicks nodded.
No way to get her body out of there. The Willis Wall cleaves constantly. My climbing rangers won't go there, and I don't blame them.
So, the perfect place for someone to stage their own death, Tracy said.
Apparently, but that's not what I was thinking at the time.
You thought it was the perfect place for the husband to kill the wife, Kins said.
No reason for her to put on her crampons and other gear just to go to the bathroom.
Makes sense, Tracy said. Hicks sat and leaned back.
I was convinced he shoved her over the side, right up until I came in late yesterday and saw that flyer on my computer you sent out. I don't forget those missing on the mountain, he said. They're permanently imprinted on my mind.
So what do you think happened now? Kins asked.
Now? Now I don't know what to think. But I'll tell you this. She didn't make it off that mountain on her own. No way. Somebody had to have helped her. Hell, the husband could have been in on it for the insurance money. The Pierce County detective said they took out a policy and there were problems in the marriage, Hicks said.
Tracy had made contact with the Pierce County Sheriff's Office that morning. They had an appointment to speak to the investigating detective from the Major Crimes Division later that day. I spoke to the detective this morning. He said the husband was a person of interest, Tracy said.
Maybe.
Hicks picked up Andrea Strickland's picture.
Thing is, I don't know now if this exonerates him or implicates him.
Hicks looked up at the red X he'd circled.
But I guess that's not my job anymore. My job is done. Looks like yours is just getting started.
Chapter 8, October 2016. I'd had more than my share of doubts about Genesis, but Graham had been so optimistic, so sure of its success, that I had finally relented despite my reservations. I don't want to say Graham wore me down, or that I caved to his repeated attempts at persuading me, but it had become so unbearable at home I knew we couldn't go on the way we had been. Graham would come home and slowly begin with the numbers,
then tell me he'd spoken to another dispensary in Washington and about how much money we would make. When I tried to question his numbers, he would dismiss me or accuse me of not supporting him. Then he would either leave pissed off and not come back until late, or sulk the rest of the evening and not say two words. He needed my income to get the loan. When I finally said yes, his eyes widened like a man who'd just been told he was cancer-free, and he gave me a bear hug and a kiss. "You're not going to regret this," he said, holding me by the shoulders. "This will be the best money we've ever invested." Then he hugged me again. "I hope you're right," I said, trying to smile through my apprehension. "I can feel this, Andrea." He paced the apartment. "I can feel this is going to be my big chance." We'd lit a strawberry-scented candle and made love that night on the couch, the way we had when first married, like it mattered, like I mattered. Thereafter, our lovemaking sessions continued almost nightly, until we went to visit the banker about our business loan. We had to disclose our assets and debts. The only debt I knew of was the lease on Graham's Porsche. We had no real savings, despite Graham saying we'd save money because he'd moved into my loft. I was uncomfortable with him lying about becoming a partner at BSBT, and already nervous when we sat down on the opposite side of the desk from the banker, a tall, officious-looking man with a head of silver hair who asked a lot of questions and filled out forms. After about 45 minutes, he looked rather grave and said to Graham, "You have quite a bit of credit card debt." I was not aware of that. "I had a sick parent, and I'm the primary caregiver," he said. "But that's over now." I was surprised at the ease with which Graham lied. "Well, do you have a way to pay that down?" the banker asked. "I'm going to have a substantial increase in income when I make partner," Graham said. "When will that be?" "I believe it's first of the year," Graham said. "Perhaps you could provide a letter from the law firm confirming that?" "Certainly," Graham said. Maybe it was my nerves, but I suddenly felt compelled to mention my parents' trust, though its terms would not allow me to use it as collateral. Graham went white as a sheet. I swear I could hear the thud of his jaw hitting the desk. He leaned forward, though there was no way the banker could not overhear our conversation. "You have a trust," he said. I glanced at the banker. He sat with the uncomfortable smile of a man who'd walked in on an argument and was trying to find an inconspicuous way to exit. He made an excuse about having to find some other form and left his desk. "What are you talking about?" Graham asked. "When my parents died, their estate was left for me in trust. I gained limited access to it when I turned 21. Graham stared at me with a look of disbelief, then glanced over his shoulder to be sure the banker was out of earshot. He leaned even closer, his jaw taut and his voice hushed. "Jesus H. Christ, Andrea, when did you plan on telling me about this?"
"I didn't think it was relevant," I said.
"Not relevant?" He cleared his throat and sat back, lips pursed. "What are we doing here?" He asked the question in that patronizing voice I hated, like I was a child. "We're borrowing money that we're going to be paying interest on because I thought we needed it."
"We do need it."
"Maybe not," he said. "How much is in the trust?"
"It's not important, Graham," he scoffed.
"Not important? I'm your husband. What other secrets have you been keeping from me?"
"What? I'm not keeping. No, that's not what I mean."
"What do you mean? Because it sure sounds like you've been keeping a very big secret from me."
"I mean it's not relevant because we can't use the trust. We can't use the money."
"You mean you won't use it?"
"No, I mean we can't."
His cheeks flushed red, and his blue eyes became more a shade of gray. "Why the hell not?"
"Because of the way my parents had the trust set up. It's designated as my separate property and has restrictions on how it can be used. It can't be invested in a business. It's just for my well-being.
Your parents are dead, he said, emphasizing each word.
I'm aware of that, Graham. But the terms of the trust still remain in place. When I turned 21, I had full say in the use of the interest, but there are restrictions on the principal until I turn 35. My parents set it up that way so I would always be taken care of. In truth, I knew my parents well enough to know they'd set it up that way so no one could ever take advantage of me, marry me, believing they would get half the money, or take it from me in a divorce.
So it's yours and yours alone? Graham said.
Technically, yes.
What does that mean, technically?
It means, what do you think I've been using to help make ends meet each month when we didn't have enough money to pay the rent, or the lease on the Porsche, and the other expenses? I've been using the interest money I get from the trust.
Oh, so you're saying what, I'm some kind of sponge?
No, I'm not saying that.
I wanted to scream. How much is the trust?
I didn't want to answer.
His jaw clenched. How much, Andrea?
The principal is $500,000.
Graham scoffed and laughed at once. It sounded almost like a man choking. Are you kidding me? You're sitting on $500,000? What the hell are we doing here?
I told you I can't use it.
Andrea, I'm a lawyer. Every contract can be broken, and a trust is basically a contract.
Not this one, I said.
My trustee said my parents had it put together so that it can't be broken. He shook his head and rolled his eyes. Why don't you let me worry about that? Can you get the money?
It can't be done, Graham.
Can you get it?
I can get it, but I can't use it for this type of stuff. So I say we end the lease on the Porsche, apply that money to your credit card debt, and get our loan as we'd intended.
Graham bit his lower lip and rolled his eyes. You want me to give up my Porsche? I'm a lawyer, Andrea. I have to maintain a certain image.
But you won't be a lawyer anymore.
Thankfully, the banker cleared his throat when he came back to his desk. Are we set to move forward? He asked. Graham still looked angry, but he smiled as if nothing was wrong. Of course, he said. Let's get this ball rolling. Graham remained upset for the next 2 days. He traded in his Porsche and we applied the lease payment to his credit card bill. I also chipped in another $2,000. I intend to pay you back, he said.
I wasn't holding my breath.
Nor did I really care. I'd never cared about money. I'd gotten by with virtually nothing my entire life, and now it seemed money just created problems. The third day, Graham came home with a bouquet of flowers and an apology. I almost wished he hadn't. Just when I thought I'd figured out his mood for the week, it would swing again. I'm sorry I've been such a jerk, he said, handing me the fragrant bouquet. It's just that you really caught me out of the blue at the bank, and I felt like I'd been put in an embarrassing situation, you know? I mean, here I was, getting ready to take out a bank loan, and I'm supposed to be a lawyer, and I didn't even know my wife had this massive trust.
I should have told you, I said, though it was more to appease him. It's just, like I said, I didn't think it would make any difference since we can't use it.
Then why did you bring it up?
I was nervous. I didn't want you to lie on a bank application and say you were going to be made a partner of the firm.
He smiled, but it was patronizing. Andrea, you're such a goody-two-shoes. Nobody is going to check on that. But it's cute that you were looking out for me, and I get it. We can't use the trust for the business, but hey, it's nice to know that we have it, right? I mean, it's like we have a net under the trapeze.
What do you mean? I asked, suddenly leery of where he was taking the conversation.
I mean, we can use it if things get a little tight getting the business up and running, or to do things like travel or buy a boat, you know, fun things as a couple.
Wouldn't it be great to have a boat?
I mean, we can use it like that. Can't we?
I suppose, I said, wary. The interest, anyway.
He leaned closer. Do you forgive me?
Sure, I said. What else was I to do?
You know what I want to do?
He moved quickly, the way he did when he had a thought that excited him. I was praying he wasn't about to say, have sex. I want to go out to dinner and celebrate our new business, someplace special.
With Graham, I was learning that special meant expensive, and I already knew whose credit card we'd be using. Over the next 2 months, the bank approved the loan, and Graham searched for space to rent and researched inventory. He'd been energized, upbeat, and excited, like the Graham I'd met and married. He couldn't get enough of me either. We had sex all over the loft and in creative ways. I'd tried to be optimistic that the business would succeed, but my doubt grew when Graham told me he'd found a small shop right there in the Pearl District, which was one of the highest rent districts in Portland. And that was saying something. I'd read an article that said since 2015, Portland's residential and commercial rents had shot through the roof. All the newspapers lamented how Portland was losing its identity, as longtime residents and small businesses were forced farther and farther out of the city core. The rent on my loft had skyrocketed from $900 a month to $1,250 in just 3 years, and the space Graham chose to open Genesis was $23 a square foot. I tried to persuade him to open the dispensary in a more industrial area, where the rent was $11 a square foot, where we would have plenty of parking, and where we would be farther away from the medical dispensaries. But Graham dismissed it. It's the first rule of real estate, he said. Location, location, location. We're going to be in a prime location within walking distance of all the businesses and law firms, and that's where the money is. Those are the people we're going to cater to. Besides, think of the money we'll save by not having to drive. Between the bank loan payment, the rents on the loft and the building space, and Graham's lease on his Porsche, which he renewed once we got the loan, we were going to have to clear close to $6,000 a month just to break even. That didn't include our regular expenses or the cost of the business permit to sell marijuana, and Graham had pretty much blown through the loan on our portion of the tenant improvements and other startup costs. He kept opting for upgrades like Brazilian hardwood floors and high-end glass cabinets with recessed lighting to display the different kinds of pot, as if it were jewelry. I want this place to shout class when people come in, he said. I don't want to be catering to some low-life losers. I didn't care who we catered to, so long as those low-life losers had real American dollars. But if I expressed any reservation or tried to get him to opt for a cheaper alternative, he'd just smile and say, "Relax. We have the trust income we can pull from if we're a little short this month." Beyond all of that, I was worried, because I'd been reading that city officials were contemplating allowing Portland's medical marijuana dispensaries to sell to recreational users. It would be a huge windfall for the dispensaries. They wouldn't have the same startup costs and could drive down the price, not to mention increase competition. When I brought it up with Graham, however, he dismissed it. Those places are pits. That's not our clientele. And our reputation is already spreading.
And it seemed it was, to some extent, anyway. They ran an article in the Portland Tribune, the free weekly paper, and it included a picture of Graham standing beneath the store entrance and green neon Genesis sign. Graham had framed the article and the photograph and hung both on a wall in the store. And for those first few months, Graham came home happy, and our lovemaking sessions remained frequent and fierce, and I thought that maybe, just maybe, everything was going to be all right. Chapter 9. Tracy scanned the significant number of web hits for Andrea Strickland on her iPad as Kins drove down the mountain. With a portion of Mount Rainier located in Pierce County, the Pierce County Sheriff's Department had asserted jurisdiction over the disappearance of Andrea Strickland. The case had generated a lot of publicity.
The DA had been careful not to call Graham Strickland a suspect, but, of course, he was. He was the prime suspect. The infamous murder of a pregnant Lacey Peterson in Modesto, California, had beaten that point home. The sad truth was that more people died at the hands of people they knew and loved than from some random killer. Stan Fields, the detective from Pierce County's Major Crimes Division, told Tracy over the phone he'd be happy to speak with her. She sensed that Fields, like Ranger Glenn Hicks, didn't appreciate having the wool pulled over his eyes by Andrea Strickland, or by both her and her husband. And Andrea Strickland had fooled them. She'd fooled everybody, at least for 6 weeks. Everybody but the person who'd eventually killed her. Fields' ego likely wouldn't let him admit he'd been fooled. No detective liked to admit that, which was why, during what should have been a short telephone conversation to set up their meeting, Fields had felt compelled to add that he'd suspected things were not as they'd seemed. When Tracy sensed the content of the internet articles becoming redundant, she closed her iPad and wedged it in the space between her seat and the center console. She grabbed her plastic water bottle and took a sip, but the water had become lukewarm. Even in the air-conditioned car, she felt sticky from the heat. She was the perfect candidate to disappear, she said, returning her water bottle to its designated holder. Parents deceased, no siblings, no one to miss her. Except, of course, the husband, Kin said. He shifted in his seat, also looking uncomfortable, and no doubt wishing he could exchange his blue jeans for a pair of shorts like Ranger Hicks wore. Blue jeans were standard attire for Kins when not in court, and it seemed an odd choice. 4 years of college football and a year in the NFL had left him with overdeveloped calves and thighs, even a decade after he'd retired. I'm assuming no kids? Thankfully, not, Tracy said. Work colleagues? She and her husband owned a marijuana dispensary in downtown Portland. It was just the two of them. Oregon had followed Washington and Colorado in legalizing marijuana, which had come as little surprise to anyone who knew the state's politics. The populace was generally considered even more liberal than Western Washington, which was saying a lot. Like I said, she wasn't going to be missed. Kins glanced in the rearview mirror, put on a blinker, and exited the highway. What did they do before selling dope? He's an attorney. She worked at an insurance company in downtown Portland. That caused Kins to glance over at her. Insurance? I've got it on the list of questions to ask him about. So neither of them was stupid. Definitely not stupid, Tracy agreed. She adjusted the vents on the dash so the cool air hit her neck and chest, and she fanned her shirt. They drove through Tacoma's mostly deserted surface streets, residents seeking refuge in air-conditioned offices and retail establishments. How far did Pierce County get in their investigation of the husband? Kins asked. According to the detective and the articles I found, the DA named him as a person of interest, but not a suspect. Tracy said. So, he was the suspect, Kin said. Clearly. But not charged? Without the body, they probably didn't think they had sufficient evidence, Tracy said. Only two people know what happened on that mountain, and one was presumed dead. So everything's circumstantial. Hopefully this guy Fields can shed some light on it. Stan Fields had suggested they meet at a restaurant on Pacific Avenue called Viola. The last time Tracy had visited Tacoma, a decade earlier, Pacific Avenue had been a haven for prostitutes and drug dealers, the buildings graffiti-tagged with gang symbols and the streets littered with trash. Downtown Tacoma had been undergoing a massive renovation by community activists and business leaders tired of the city being known as the blue-collar stepchild to Seattle, more for a blend of industrial stink referred to as the aroma of Tacoma. Pacific Avenue was clearly a part of that renovation. The two- and three-story stucco and brick industrial buildings had been renovated and freshly painted. Storefront advertising revealed professional businesses, retail stores, boutique shops, and restaurants. Kins found a parking spot at a meter half a block from the restaurant. As they approached, Tracy noticed a man standing outside the restaurant, smoking in a patch of shade. He made eye contact, nodded, and blew out smoke.
"You cross white?" he said.
Stan Fields looked like a holdover from the 70s, with slate-gray hair pulled back in a short ponytail. A bushy mustache drooped below the corners of his mouth, as if weighted by the heat. Fields wore a dark blue polo shirt that bore the department's emblem, the words Pierce County Sheriff stitched in gold over snow-covered Mount Rainier. Tracy introduced herself and Kins.
"I got a table inside," Fields said.
He raised the cigarette to his lips for the final extended drag of a chain smoker about to go cold turkey for at least half an hour, then blew a stream of smoke into the sky and flicked the burning cigarette into the gutter. Viola had glass doors pulled back on runners to allow for outdoor seating, though today no one sat at the sun-drenched wrought iron tables and chairs. The open doors allowed the heat, sticky as syrup, to seep inside, and the overhead ceiling paddles looked sluggish in their effort to offer relief. Tracy removed her sunglasses. It took a moment for her eyes to adjust to the darkened interior. Fields led them to a booth near the kitchen, the brick walls adorned with colorful Impressionist paintings. Tracy and Kins slid across the booth from Fields onto a leather bench seat. Sweat trickled down Tracy's back from the short walk and caused her shirt to stick to her skin. Fields nodded to two glasses on their side of the table.
"I ordered you water. Figured you'd be thirsty after the drive."
Tracy and Kins thanked him. Each took long drinks. What Tracy wanted was to run the cool glass over her forehead and down her neck, but decided it would be unprofessional.
"I moved here to escape the heat," Fields said, sounding perturbed.
Most Northwest transplants complained about the rain and overcast gray skies. It rang odd to hear someone complain about the heat, though Seattleites were quick to blame their changing weather patterns on global warming, or what Foz unapologetically called global whining.
"Where are you from?" Tracy asked. Rich smells of garlic and butter and sage wafted from the kitchen.
"Phoenix," Fields said. "But moved around a lot as a kid. My dad was in the army."
"The hottest summer I ever spent was a winter in Phoenix," Kins said.
"Tell me about it."
Fields had a habit of twitching his mouth, which made his mustache move like the whiskers of a mouse, likely a tick.
"I started out running the borders down there with INS, then moved to narcotics, mostly undercover. Spent more time than I cared to in the desert tracking drug runners."
Fields had the weathered face of someone whom the sun had baked for a few years. With the ponytail and gravelly voice of a smoker, he fit the part of an undercover narcotics agent, and Tracy was picking up the cocky demeanor those officers needed to be convincing.
"Tough gig," Kins said. "Wears you out after a few years."
"Yeah? You do it?"
Fields asked.
2 years, Kins said.
Kins had grown out his hair and a wispy goatee, and someone in narcotics had christened him Sparrow, after the Johnny Depp character in the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. The nickname stuck. Unlike Fields, however, Kins had been eager to cut his hair and shave when he left narcotics.
"When did you move to Tacoma?" Kins asked, running a finger along the condensation on the outside of his glass.
Tracy sensed he was giving them all a chance to settle in, while also getting a feel for Fields. Fields was likely doing the same.
"Just about a year ago. I lost my wife and needed a change of scenery. I was tired of the heat and the sun. I was looking for rain and fog. Seattle wasn't hiring detectives, but Tacoma was."
"Sorry about your wife," Tracy said. Fields gave a curt nod.
"She was undercover, too. Got too close. Someone ratted her out. They shot her and left her in the desert."
The news gave Tracy a different perspective of Fields, who at first impression didn't evoke much sympathy. Losing a spouse was horrific under any circumstances, but losing a spouse in the line of duty
and in that manner, could eat at a person. No wonder Fields had left Arizona.
Did they get the people who did it? Kins asked.
Fields gave them a sidelong glance, intended to convey they'd done more than arrest the killers.
Yeah, we got 'em.
The waitress appeared, and Fields shifted his gaze, grinning at the tall young woman like she was on the appetizer menu.
You got the company card?
He asked Tracy, meaning the ability to expense the meal.
Yeah,
Kins said.
Then I'll take a 16-ounce pale ale and your linguine and clams, Fields said, without considering a menu. Tell the chef I like enough garlic so my cat won't love me for a week.
He gave the waitress a wink. The young woman responded with an uncomfortable smile and quickly looked to Tracy and Kins's side of the table.
Diet Coke, Kins said, and a bucket of water I can throw over my head.
The waitress smiled. Tracy said she was good with the glass of water. Fields gave the waitress's backside a lingering once-over when she turned and walked off, which was not only disrespectful, but ridiculous. He was old enough to be the young woman's father, but in Tracy's experience that didn't stop some men from thinking they had a chance. Fields re-engaged Tracy. If he was self-conscious, Tracy had busted him. He didn't show it. In fact, she got the impression he enjoyed getting caught. Pathetic.
"Nothing to eat," Fields said. "Best perk of the job."
"We stopped for a late lunch," Tracy said, feeling nauseated. Fields draped an arm over the back of the booth.
"So, Andrea Strickland is dead. Again."
"Apparently so," Tracy said. The mustache twitched.
"I'd have bet my badge the husband gave her a little shove off the mountain. I was sure he killed her."
"Maybe he still did," Kins said.
"Maybe," Fields said.
"Can you fill us in on your investigation?" Kins asked.
The waitress set Fields's beer and Kins's Diet Coke on coasters. Fields took more than a sip and wiped foam from his mustache with the paper napkin.
"His story didn't add up."
He set down his beer and sat back, again draping one arm over the back of the booth.
"It stunk. Wife gets up to take a pee and he doesn't get up with her, or wonder where she is. You talk to people who climb that mountain and they'll tell you they don't sleep well, if at all, the night before they summit. They lay down when it's still light out and the adrenaline and anxiety are pumping. But this guy says he slept so soundly he didn't even know she was gone. Come on. So my radar was already pinging before I ever met the guy."
He looked at Tracy, and his eyes took a quick dive to her cleavage.
"And my radar is rarely wrong."
"What'd you find?" Tracy asked, her skin now crawling for reasons that had nothing to do with the heat.
"Turns out the wife took out an insurance policy naming him the beneficiary shortly before they climbed. $250,000. That was the first red flag."
"Did he take out a policy naming her?" Kins asked.
"Nope," Field said. "He said she had some kind of trust fund from her parents, and, according to him, he and the wife figured if anything happened to him, she'd be fine. That was his story, anyway. Me, I'm thinking that he's thinking, why pay a second premium?"
"We understand they'd climbed before," Tracy said.
"Once and didn't take out policies," Field said, finishing her thought. "And the wife worked for an insurance company before they opened the marijuana shop."
"So she knew the ins and outs of the business?" Tracy asked.
"She was a flunky, but according to her boss, she was smart. Picked up things quick."
"You consider they could have been in on something together?" Kins asked.
"I was working under the strong premise he killed her, but yeah, I was open to that possibility."
"Did the husband recover the insurance proceeds?"
"Not yet, not with the investigation active. But he wasted no time filing for the benefits after he got off the mountain. I made a call. His claim is still under investigation. Looks like it will be a while."
Tracy looked to Kins. If the husband and wife had been working together, the delay might not have been something they'd anticipated.
Or the husband could have made the wife think they were in it together, then killed her.
Since she was already technically dead and no one was going to find her body in a crab pot, no one would be any wiser, Kin said.
Maybe, Tracy said. But if that was the case, why wouldn't he just push her off the mountain? Why wait to kill her?
The husband's one of those guys that's just easy to not like. You know the type?
Field said, over the sound of banging pans and voices coming from the kitchen. Tracy did. She was sitting across from one of them.
Anything else set off your radar? She asked.
Yeah. Their new business venture wasn't going well. In fact, it had tanked, Field said. No surprise there. Husband set it up in a high-rent district in downtown Portland, thinking they'd be a more upscale establishment and capture all the business crowd potheads. Here's a fun fact. Turns out Portland has more medical marijuana dispensaries than almost any other city in the country. What a surprise, huh? Well, shortly after the law went into effect legalizing marijuana, a city ordinance allowed the dispensaries to sell retail. Two were close to the Strickland's store. Portland also has a robust black market, meaning the non-business crowd had a readily available and cheaper source.
How bad was it? Tracy asked.
I got the sense, talking with the wife's boss, that Andrea Strickland had been more than reticent about the business, but the husband had talked her into it. She had a large trust.
How large? Tracy asked. Field smiled.
The principal was $500,000.
No shit, Kin said.
No shit. But the terms prohibited her from using it to start a business, Field said.
Kin's whistled.
Tell me about it, Field said. So they borrowed $250,000 from the bank and signed personal guarantees on both the lease and on the loan. Also turns out the husband lied on the loan application.
Lied how? Tracy asked.
Said he was being made a partner of his firm, with a substantial increase in salary, even presented a letter from the managing partner. Turns out he forged the letter. The firm had already told him to hit the bricks.
The waitress arrived with Fields's linguine. He lowered his arm and asked for grated cheese. Tracy watched him eye the woman's breasts as she worked the hunk of Parmesan over the grater. The long hair and mustache weren't the only things Fields had cut from his undercover days. Some of the sleaze had also rubbed off on him. Any sympathy she'd felt for him for having lost his wife had quickly waned.
"Thank you, darling," Field said, when the young woman finished.
As the waitress departed, probably to take a scalding shower in disinfectant, Fields looked to Kins and Tracy.
"You sure you don't want anything? It's good food. I come here at least once a week."
The waitresses must have been thrilled about that.
"We're good," Kin said.
Fields twirled his fork in the pasta and brought a ball to his mouth. He wouldn't have to worry about his cat. From the smell drifting across the table, the garlic was strong enough to kill a grizzly.
"What more can you tell us about the husband?" Tracy asked.
Fields wiped his mustache on his napkin and sipped his beer.
"Like I said, a big shot. Drove a Porsche and wore those suits that look like they're a size too small. Smarter than everybody, too, always looking for the next big deal just around the corner, and believed it was just a matter of time before one of them paid off. Big bullshitter. I think he convinced the wife this was their ticket. They pretty much liquidated all their community assets and put it into the store. He'd also maxed out their credit cards, and the creditors were calling. And like I said, the bank found out about the forged letter from the law firm, and he was looking at criminal prosecution and maybe a little jail time if he couldn't pay back the money.
So you thought he was after the wife's trust? Kin said.
I did, Field said in between another bite of his pasta. Seems that money disappeared from Andrea's personal account.
Disappeared where? Tracy asked.
Don't know. The husband swears he had nothing to do with it and has no idea where it went.
What about the trustee?
Same thing. No idea.
You think the husband and wife could have been trying to hide it from the creditors?
Yep. You said she had a Washington license under a different name?
Lynn Hoff, Tracy said.
Then I'm betting that's where you'll find the money.
Tracy recalled the receipt for the Emerald Credit Union she'd found in the garbage can at the motel room. Field sat back with a shit-eating grin.
Then there was the little issue of the girlfriend.
I figured that was coming, Kin said.
There's always a girlfriend, am I right?
Fields used a hunk of bread to wipe up sauce from his plate.
You talk to her? Kins asked.
Fields shook his head.
Haven't determined who she is yet. Andrea told her boss she thought her husband was cheating on her, but she didn't say with who.
Any evidence that was the case? Tracy asked.
I was still running it down, but apparently it wasn't the first time. He'd been banging a little hottie from his law firm before they got married, and I guess didn't think a wedding ban should inhibit that activity.
You talked to her? Tracy asked.
Ain't my first rodeo, detective.
He popped a piece of bread into his mouth. Tracy really didn't like this guy.
She says she broke it off when she found out he'd gotten married. Apparently he'd kept that little trinket from her for a couple months.
Sounds like a dirtbag, Kin said.
Yeah,
Fields nodded.
The wife also told her boss she was going to consult a divorce lawyer.
Did she? Tracy asked.
No evidence she did.
I think I'm seeing her motivation for disappearing, Kin said.
Divorce doesn't get her out of the debt with the personal guarantees out there, Fields said. And because Oregon is a community property state, Andrea was jointly liable for all the debts.
She was worried she'd lose her trust, Tracy said.
He declares bankruptcy no big deal, Fields said. He's got nothing but debt.
Her?
She's sitting on a big pile of money the creditors would love to go after.
Why'd they take out a loan in the first place? Kins asked.
Like I said,
Fields took another bite of the linguine.
She wouldn't let him use the trust money.
Kins looked at Tracy.
Yeah,
Field said, reading the look.
The guy's got motivation up the ass to kill her.
In which case, he would have just shoved her off the mountain, Tracy said, thinking there had to be something more to it.
It was a perfect setup, Field said, shrugging. People die on that mountain every year. I think that's why it was just the two of them, no guide. Husband claims wife's death was a tragic accident. Who was going to be any wiser?
But he's a lawyer, Tracy said, still not completely convinced. He had to have at least realized that the bankruptcy, the insurance policy, and the bad marriage, not to mention the girlfriend, would be pretty solid circumstantial evidence it was no accident.
He claimed he didn't know about the insurance policy, Field said, or about any girlfriend.
He says it was her idea to take out the policy? Tracy asked.
And to climb the mountain, Field said. Like I said, I was sure he killed her. Now? Well, she's unhappy too, right? Field said. So maybe she sees this trip up the mountain as the perfect opportunity to fake her own death, get out of a bad marriage, and stick the husband with the bills and headaches.
And maybe get even for the girlfriend while she's at it, Kin said.
Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, Field said,
wiping the corners of his mustache with the napkin. Maybe, Tracy said. Or maybe she suspected the husband didn't intend for her to make it off the mountain, and beat him at his own game.
Why would she go if she knew he was going to try and kill her? Kin said.
She has to go, if she wants to fake her death to get out of the marriage and the debt, Tracy said. Kins shook his head.
She could have just run.
Running doesn't mean she's dead, Tracy said. This way she hides the trust money, plants some seeds, like the insurance policy, and tells her boss the husband is cheating on her and she wants a divorce. When he goes to sleep, she walks off knowing everyone will blame the husband. She looked to Fields. The ranger says she had to have help getting off the mountain.
Yeah, I know, but I don't know who that would have been. Her parents are deceased, and the only relative is an aunt in San Bernardino who hasn't been in contact with her since Andrea left for Portland. Numbers in the file. There's the husband.
"Who we can rule out," Kin said.
"Her boss and one friend," Field said.